A new asteroid with a 1% chance of hitting Earth in 2032. The European Space Agency is building a lunar lander platform. The largest structure in the universe has been discovered. And how far away could we detect ourselves? All this and more in this week's Space Bites. Every now and then, astronomers discover an asteroid that has a non-zero chance of hitting the Earth at some time in the future. And you're probably familiar with asteroid Apophis, which for the longest time was the greatest asteroid of risk. And then astronomers did follow-on observations and dialed that risk down to zero. Well, now astronomers have found a new asteroid that you should be mildly intrigued by, no more than that. Anyway, it's got a 3 on the Torino scale. And this is a measurement scale where 0 is don't worry about it at all, and 10 is Armageddon. And so this asteroid, designated 2024 YR4, measures between 40 and 100 meters across. And if it did strike the Earth, it's a city killer. So think of the Tunguska explosion in 1908. And we get hit by asteroids about this big every 1,000 to 2,000 years. But you should absolutely not panic. This is very common. Astronomers find a new asteroid. It's only got a few measurements so far. They run the calculations. It has a non-zero chance of hitting the Earth, but there's wide uncertainties. And then more astronomers come on board, more observations are done, and they dial down that uncertainty, and they know that it's not going to hit the Earth. And so right now we're in this point where they haven't dialed that uncertainty down to zero. It is 1% hitting the Earth in 2032. But the European Space Agency's Space Mission Planning Advisory Group is already looking into what would it take to launch a mission quickly and try and push it out of the way in 7 years from now. Even if they determine that it's not risky, I think it would still be worth doing to launch a mission, try and push an asteroid out of its orbit in a more slow way, as opposed to, say, the DART mission, which crashed into one. So I'll keep you updated, and I'll let you know the inevitable point when its risk gets dialed down to zero. Don't look up. The European Space Agency is building a lunar lander platform. There are so many missions going to the moon. China is sending a series of landers to the moon, and already have. The US is sending lunar landers with its commercial lunar payloads program. You've got other nations, Japan, Israel, India, and now the European Space Agency is getting into the lunar lander game. They've contracted Thales Alenia Space out of Italy to build the Argonaut lander platform. And so what this is going to be is a more generic lunar lander. It will have a very standard descent and cargo module, but then it can carry different payloads. And it's designed to operate on the surface of the moon for about 5 years. And that's really interesting because a lot of the missions that have gone to the moon aren't designed to last longer than a single lunar day. And so there's going to be some engineering for it to be able to keep its instruments warm during the lunar night. And so it can just keep operating. Because this is all going to be modular, they'll be able to build and launch multiple of these lunar landers. So the first one could fly as soon as 2031, and then you would see repeat missions after that, each one lasting 5 years. Recent geological activity on the moon. The moon formed about 100 million years after the Earth and the rest of the solar system formed. And the common thinking is that a Mars-sized object crashed into the Earth, and then the debris eventually coalesced into the moon. Now, when it first started out, it was just a ball of molten rock. And then over the course of billions of years, the rock cooled down, and eventually it cooled down completely. But you still had volcanic eruptions as it was cooling and shrinking, kind of squishing the lava out onto the surface. And we can see these lunar mare. These are the darker regions on the side of the moon that faces us. That is evidence of giant volcanic flows over hundreds of millions of years. But astronomers think that that volcanic activity wrapped up several billion years ago. But now they've found new evidence that in fact there might still be some volcanic activity on the moon. They found a series of ridges on the far side of the moon. The way you figure out age on the moon is that you count craters. You look at the distribution of craters on the moon, and you know approximately when that surface was fresh and then how long it's just been getting hit by space rocks over time. And what they found is that these ridges on the far side of the moon cut through existing older craters, which means that the craters formed first and then this volcanic ridging formed after that. And they think that this could have formed within the last 200 million years or so. And so the moon isn't completely dead, it's just mostly dead. Grand Canyons on the moon. And speaking of features on the moon, there's a really fascinating region near the south pole of the moon. It's called the Schrödinger Basin, and it is the point of impact from a really large object that smashed into the moon billions of years ago. And if you look, you can see these two gashes in the moon that are coming out from this Schrödinger Basin. One of these is called Valles Schrödinger, and the other is called Valles Planck, which is awesome. And planetary scientists have been wondering, like, how did these form? And now researchers think they've got an answer, which is that when this impactor smashed into the moon, it threw out debris, and specifically, you had debris in this torrent, almost like water, blasting out of this basin from the impact, going at about 4,500 kilometers per hour. Now, that's actually not fast enough to go into escape trajectory. It's about half the speed you need to leave the moon, but still, it scoured these two canyons within about 10 minutes. And just for comparison, like, these things are deeper than the Grand Canyon. In some cases, they're almost as wide as the Grand Canyon, about as long as the Grand Canyon. And so these are enormous structures. And while on Earth, the Grand Canyon took hundreds of thousands, millions of years to form by water, these formed in 10 minutes. Now, this is near the south pole of the moon, and that means that when the Artemis astronauts go to the moon, this is the kind of region that they're going to be exploring, and maybe we'll be able to pick up some more information and maybe see some of the geological evidence that was left behind when this event happened. How far away could we detect ourselves? Humanity has been providing evidence of our existence into the cosmos for quite some time now. You can think back, there was a time when we first went into the Industrial Revolution and we were starting to put out nitrogen dioxide, various chemicals into the atmosphere of the Earth, our industrial pollutants. And then we learned to build radio towers and send radio transmissions. But also we have the cities on Earth that are putting radiation into space. We have satellites that are passing in front of the Earth, passing in front of the sun. And so there are a bunch of ways that we could be leaking our existence out into the cosmos. And so if we then flip that and say, well, based on our ability to detect those kinds of signals, how far away could we see ourselves with our current technology? So a new paper came out that did these calculations and compared the various ways that we put technosignatures into space and then looked at the kinds of ways that we can detect technosignatures. Most of the technosignatures that we give off don't actually go very far. The city lights on the Earth, satellite transits, this wouldn't be visible beyond about the Oort cloud. But that nitrogen dioxide pollutant in the atmosphere, the directed lasers that humanity has blasted off into space, and some of the most powerful radio signals that we give off, those could be detectable out to, say, Proxima Centauri. In other words, if we had our instruments at Proxima Centauri, then we could detect ourselves. The Deep Space Network, which is how NASA communicates with the various spacecraft around the solar system, that could reach about 100 light years away. And the most powerful signal that humanity sends into space was from the planetary radar system that was built into the Arecibo Observatory. And this was this radar system that they used to scan various asteroids and objects in the solar system. They would fire this really powerful pulse of radio waves at an asteroid, and then it would reflect back. They would measure the shape of the reflection and then use that to map out the surface of these asteroids. If we were watching Earth when the planetary radar was fired, we could see ourselves from about 10,000 light years away. Now, obviously, it would take 10,000 years for the signals to get there and so on, but that's just showing how far some of our technosignatures have gone into space. And of course, as our ability to produce signals grows stronger and as our ability to detect signals gets better, those numbers will increase over time. Every week, we do a vote on our channel where we ask you to tell us what you thought was the best space news of the week. And the winner last week was the news about the OSIRIS-REx samples. Now, I've been telling you that it's on the community tab, and apparently YouTube has changed the name for what this is called. It's now called the posts tab. And so if you're on our channel, you'll see the post tab, and that's where you can see the vote. You can go and vote a bunch of times, and then that should tell the algorithm that you want to see more of these, you want to participate in this. But of course, if you subscribe to the channel, click on the notifications bell, that will help train the algorithm to show you more of this vote, and then you can join in the fun. The largest structure in the universe. The solar system is part of the Milky Way. The Milky Way is part of the local group, which has a couple of other large galaxies and a bunch of dwarf galaxies. The local group is part of the Virgo cluster. The Virgo cluster is part of the Virgo supercluster. That is part of the Lanikea supercluster and maybe part of the Shapley supercluster. And so they kind of go up, get bigger and bigger and bigger. And so astronomers are always trying to understand the large scale structure of the universe, especially in our vicinity. And after a recent survey, they've announced they found the largest known structure. This is a collection of galaxies that spans 1.3 billion light years across. It contains 200 quadrillion solar masses. And like, just for comparison, the most massive galaxy that's ever been found in the entire universe has 1 quadrillion solar masses. So this is the equivalent of 200 of those, but like many more galaxies. And they gave it a name, which is quipu. That refers to an ancient Incan recording device where they would use knots to measure numbers. And the astronomers thought that the sort of shape and structure of quipu reminded them of this device. And so with the survey that the astronomers were doing, they found this one structure, quipu, but also 4 other superstructures that weren't quite as large, but they contain about 45% of the galaxy clusters in this region around us. It gives you a sense of how much of the universe is collected into these large structures compared to stuff that are farther away from their neighbors. Now, you can't really call something that big a thing because the expansion of the universe, the accelerating expansion of the universe, thanks to dark energy, is going to dissolve this superstructure over time and eventually tear it down to the size of the local group. And all of the bits and pieces will fall over the cosmic horizon from each other and won't actually be merging into one giant galaxy cluster. But they are all connected through gravity and moving together, and so that's why they're considered to be this large superstructure. Evidence for a supermassive black hole in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Now, most of the stars in the Milky Way orbit the center of the Milky Way, but occasionally astronomers find examples of stars that are on hypervelocity trajectories. And what seems to happen is you get a binary star that gets too close to the supermassive black hole at the heart of the Milky Way, goes into this three-body interaction, tears one of the stars away, and the other star gets a kick, like a slingshot, leaving the Milky Way. And so astronomers were using Gaia to map the trajectory of various stars moving in the outer halo of the Milky Way, and they found that a bunch of them seemed to originate from the Large Magellanic Cloud. And when they run those trajectories back, they calculate that there must be a supermassive black hole in the Large Magellanic Cloud with about 600,000 times the mass of the Sun. So almost a tenth of the one in the Milky Way, which is doing the same thing. It is breaking apart binary stars, throwing individual stars on hypervelocity orbits that are now, in some cases, passing into the Milky Way itself. So it's a nice explanation for these hypervelocity stars in the halo of the Milky Way, and also potential evidence for a supermassive black hole in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Finally, I'd like to show you 3 really cool images. The first is Earth. And this was a picture taken by the iSpace Hakuto R lander 2. And it launched on January 25th and took this image as it was speeding away from the Earth. And of course, it's on its way to the moon to try and make a safe landing on the moon after the first lander failed. So hopefully the next pictures that we see from Hakuto R are the ones of the moon. And it's safely on the surface of the moon. That would be perfect. This next picture is a protostar. It's a classification of star called a Harbig-Haro object. And specifically, this is HH 30 and sort of a very famous, relatively nearby Harbacaro object. It's part of the Taurus Molecular Cloud. And the picture was taken by the James Webb Space Telescope, which can see through the gas and dust that would obscure our view of it. Now you're looking at this edge on. And so you're looking right across the accretion disk that's around this protostar. And then you've got these conical outflows of gas that are leaving the poles, as well as jets that are also leaving from the poles of this star. Such an incredible image. And like eventually, this will turn into a main sequence star. So we're just seeing this star in the process of formation, going from blob of gas and dust to main sequence star. And finally, this is the galaxy Leda 1313424. But from here on, we're gonna call it the Bullseye Galaxy. It's located about 567 million light years from Earth, and astronomers have counted 9 concentric rings around this galaxy. And you can actually see the culprit, which is this blue dwarf galaxy that plunged right through the center of this galaxy millions of years ago. And then, just like you would drop a rock into water, you got these density waves that moved outward through the material in the galaxy, bunching up, causing these rings. They're kind of similar to the spiral arms inside the galaxy itself, but these were caused by the galaxy passing through the other galaxy. Now, you are watching Space Bites, but I am writing my weekly email newsletter. This contains dozens of stories, most of which you're not going to see here on Space Bites. For example, this hot Jupiter probably formed close to its star. White dwarfs pause their cooling, giving planets a second chance at life. And a recent impact on Mars shook the planet to its mantle. I send out my newsletter on Fridays. It's completely free. I write every word in the newsletter. So go to universetoday.com/newsletter to sign up. All right, I'm going to talk about our very busy schedule for the next couple of weeks. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew Gross, Bear Lake Roofing, David Giltinan, David Mounts, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Robach, Sean Sargent, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Fowler Munley, Thomas Del Scadron, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level. And all our patrons, all your support means universe to us. So I have been doing a lot of interviews recently, and I think you've probably seen over the last couple of weeks, we've pretty much released one new episode every single day, and we have so many interviews in the can right now that this will continue for weeks into the future. But then in addition to all of the videos that we're producing here on the channel, we also release much longer overtime videos. We release bonus videos from the interviews that I'm doing, as well as our enormous 3-hour patron only question show. And this is all available. Some of this stuff is available free on our Patreon. You just have to follow us for free. Others are available to the patron members. And so if you subscribe to us on Patreon, not only will you get all of the Q&As that we are doing, all of this additional material, but you'll also get access to a backlog of everything that we've done. Our patron only podcast feed is close to 100 episodes at this point. So there's a lot of additional material. If you want more question shows, more interviews, more material, it's all there. You can just unlock it. Go to patreon.com/universe today. All right. We'll see you next week.